I also think that, partly it comes down to our education, because we put a lot of emphasis on ideas and ideals. And ideals, in a certain sense, are a form of perfectionism. We want the world to fit in with our ideas. We think critically about how the world is, and we want to fix the problems. And then we apply that way of thinking inwardly towards ourselves. So we start to analyze and criticize what's going on inside of ourselves. And we criticize it from the point of view of saying, well, it doesn't measure up to a certain standard. Now, I think there's more to it than that. I think partly it's our upbringing as well, where often, our parents may have had high expectations of us. And, that can go, and I'm a teacher, that's my day job, and I see perfectionism and the problems it brings to students time and time again. It's a very, very common problem. In fact, I would even say it's like a form of mental illness, to be honest, in practice, because it makes people miserable. And perfectionism, as I see it, can manifest in two ways. One way is by people who are just constantly striving to perfect themselves, not being completely intolerant of any fault within themselves. But I also would note, and not many people are necessarily aware of this, but one thing that's quite clear to me is that another form of perfectionism is like, it's almost like rebelling against it. So I see this in young people. They try for a while to be as perfect as they can be, and then they feel like they're a failure, and so they give up, and therefore they're going to go and be the opposite. So they're going to create trouble and so forth. But actually that's coming from that failed sense of perfectionism. So the first thing, I think it's good to be aware of where perfectionism is coming from. I think it's good to be aware that it's causing tremendous amounts of mental stress. One of the things I find as a teacher is, especially with students who are really in the grip of perfectionism, is just to get them to calm down, because it can really, it's the kind of thing where the stress becomes such a problem that they cannot perform well, because the stress is occupying their mind. I mean, to perform well in anything, whether you're doing an exam or, doing a performance or giving a Dharma talk, you've got to be in the moment, absorbed in what you're doing. And actually, that's a really, that's what we're all looking for. It's, sometimes that's referred to as the state of flow, where we're in the moment, regardless of what it is we're doing. It's a peak state of being. But with perfectionism, we can't be in that state of flow, because we're constantly thinking about, what if I fail? Oh, I've got to remember this, and I can't get it wrong. And the mind gets very tightly wound up. And so one way to think of it is like, it's like when you've got a guitar and all the strings are too tight. And if they get too tight, they snap. And that's one thing to watch out for, because some people, their perfectionism has become so great that they are at risk of snapping within inside themselves. And that could lead to like some kind of emotional breakdown or something like that. So what I've talked about so far is really just to realize that I've only spoken very briefly about it, but the dimensions of that problem. Well, there's a great deal more that could be said about it, but we don't really have time. And I want to spend more time talking about why perfectionism is it's deluded. It's not seeing things as they are. It's not And it's also, it's not useful. As I say, anything, you know, peak performance comes about through being absorbed in the moment, being here and now focused for the sake of being focused. You know, because what I'm doing now matters. And it doesn't matter how well I do it, I just have to do it anyway. That's the kind of the mental attitude which gets you into that flow state. Or, you know, like with meditation, what gets you into the flow state with meditation? Just, you know, this is where Ajahn Brahm is such an incredibly skillful teacher, because I think, you know, people who know Ajahn Brahm for a long time know that he actually changed his tune, particularly in the 1990s. He started out teaching, you know, in a fairly straightforward kind of a way, you know, about, you know, how to watch the breath and doing this technique, counting and this kind of thing. But he changed his tune over a period of time because he was being responsive to the people who were learning with him. And a lot of them were really stressed out. A lot of them took their achievement-oriented thinking, which they might use in their work and in their life out there, and they started applying that criteria within themselves. And I'm true, that's true of me as well when I started out. And I really struggled. There was that whole sense of trying to control the practice and control the breath and to try and get results. And actually, it doesn't work that way. Okay. So that kind of perhaps in some ways I feel like perfectionism perhaps isn't quite the right word. Idealism, like trying to impose an ideal. This is how it should be. Or this is, you know, I want these results by such and such a time. You know, that kind of thing can work to some extent in maybe in the business world and so forth. But when it comes to our spiritual lives and when it comes to cultivating wellness within ourselves, this is counterproductive. The stress that's induced by trying to impose these ideals upon ourselves is it's something which causes us to really, really struggle in a lot of different ways. And it can be the source of, you know, it can lead to depression. It can lead to anxiety. And I think one thing that's really good about meditation and just mindfulness in general is that we can learn to be aware that these states of mind exist and get down to the root of what's going on. And hopefully also to stop judging ourselves because, and this is where Ajahn Brahm is, you know, such a genius because he just really emphasizes the need to find kindness and acceptance. And, you know, he even coined the term kindfulness, and it's so relevant. Kindfulness, in a way, is the solution to perfectionism because perfectionism is not accepting things as they are. It's saying the situation doesn't measure up. I don't measure up. I'm not good enough. And the antidote is to say everything is good enough as it is. I accept it as it is just right now. And having a sense of kindness and making peace with yourself, making peace with the present moment, making peace with the breath. That is such an important and powerful precursor to developing meditation and indeed the spiritual path. You know, perfectionism is coming from a strong sense of self. It's in trying to impose on reality our will. But the spiritual path is the opposite. The spiritual path is to let go of the will, to find acceptance, and then later on joy with what is. That's a really, really important point, is to, you know, have that sense of forgiveness, first of all, and kindness towards ourselves and towards others. Because one thing you'll notice about people who are perfectionists is that they are intolerant with themselves and they are intolerant with others. And I think when it comes to our spiritual path, we should not try to be perfect. We should try to accept our brokenness, because that is the nature of ourselves, our bodies, our minds, and it is the nature of everything else. There's a crack in everything. That's the seed of impermanence. Everything is going to break apart and is going to die, so to speak. You know, everything that's living that will die. If it's a non-living thing, you know, like this pen, you know, this mouse, you know, this microphone, you know, this internet, it's all going to break. Everything is going to break. It is going to fall apart. It's impermanent, everything, without any exception. Can we accept that? And why wouldn't we? Why wouldn't we accept it? You know, because to fight against it is going to be just a struggle. Yes, I see a question coming along.
Yeah, there is one just in the chat there for you. Would you like me to read it, or would you like to go ahead?
Is this the last one?
Yes, it's just the last one. Could a cynicism be a kind of perfectionism?
Yes, taking things to extremes. I think perhaps yes. And of course, if you read the story of the Buddha, he practiced that form of extreme asceticism for 6 years. I think it can be coming from that sense of wanting perfection, to perfect themselves spiritually. But actually, Buddhism has got a very different approach. And of course, the Buddha gave up that approach. You know, he took it to the extreme. Everyone regarded him as, at that time, this is before he was the Buddha, he was the Bodhisattva, Siddhartha Gautama. He was so extreme in his ascetic practice, everyone looked up to him. You know, he had the five ascetics. They looked up to him, and they were pretty extreme. But he got to the end of that 6 years and said, this is not working. This is not what I was looking for. So what did he do? He sat down. He had a good meal. He had a wash. He got himself comfortable, and then he sat down, and then he let go of everything. The idea of who he was, the body, everything. Let go of it all. And what happened when he let go of everything? Complete liberation. Okay, so that's instructive for all of us. You know, if we're trying to perfect ourselves, we're on the wrong track. You know, we should lower our standards. We should be more accepting towards ourselves and others. It's my other question from Therese was about death. I mean, if you really reflect upon the fact that we are not going to be here for very long, that those people that we love are not going to be here for very long, would we really demand perfection from them or from ourselves? I say no. I say that we do our best to forgive ourselves, to forgive others, to accept and care for the people who are close to us, as well as those far away if we can, but certainly those who are close to us, that's a great place to start. If we understand that they're not going to be around for very long, then we really should develop a sense of care, a sense of kindness, you know, acceptance, forgiveness. That's, I think, very, very powerful I mean, I think the presence of death is a powerful teacher, a powerful teacher. And I think also, if you can get to that point where you realize that you are suffering from some form of perfectionism and realize its futility, its harm, and also just how we ourselves are not going to be here that long, then that can give rise to a sense of letting go of these perfectionist standards and finding a sense of acceptance. And you know we don't need look how much trouble we're causing in the world today by trying to fashion the world according to our willpower. You know, we take for instance the fashion industry. It's all about looking perfect, looking a certain way. How much of that, you know, you wear it a few times and you throw it away. It's now pollution. And so much of what we're doing, so much of what our consumption, consumerist habits, is because we're constantly seeking a perfectionism which evades us. We can never find it. If you actually look at inwardly, you can see that your desires are changing all the time. Let's say, for instance, you've got this standard which you want to achieve within yourself, and then you achieve it. How long is that going to make you happy for? How long are you going to be satisfied with that? If you've been cultivating perfectionism, I tell you, it's not going to be very long. You're going to set yourself a new goal. You know, you can see this with like athletes, for instance. You know, they get a gold medal, and then they do an interview and they say, "Oh yeah, no, but I could have done better, and I'll be at the next Olympics and I'll do this." And when's it end? It doesn't. There's no fulfillment when it comes to wanting and seeking. You know, perfectionism is a form of craving and wanting. And of course, if you know the Four Noble Truths, second noble truth, wanting causes suffering. If you want to get away from suffering, you've got to let go of the wanting. And one way you can do that is to accept things as they are, to be kind to yourself and accept things as they are, to be kind to others. I mean, the world would be radically changed if we all were able to find a greater sense of peace within ourselves. We wouldn't need to go around destroying the biosphere and the environment to such an extent. I think it would be a very, very different world. And I think it all starts with us and that sense of wanting. And in our society, in our Western society, our idea of freedom is freedom to get what we want. But what we very rarely see is that we have become the slaves of what we want. We aren't free at all. So if you really want freedom, and this is from a Buddhist point of view, if you want freedom, you've got to be free from wanting. So that's a very different thing indeed. I'm getting very close to 7:30. I haven't said too much about death, but I will just say a few words briefly. I've said that it's a powerful teacher. That's a pretty heavy thing to say, because when someone close to us dies, we have a sense of loss and grief. But if we just wallow in that, it isn't going to help. If we understand that this is a powerful teacher, we can learn a great deal from it. In fact, Ajahn Chah used to say, one of my favorite sayings by Ajahn Chah, he says, the world is so confusing for people who do not understand death. And in fact, I don't know if many of you know this, but Marana Sati, reflecting upon death, is a very powerful form of meditation. And it's not often taught to lay people. I think there's a few things you probably want to be aware of before trying to do a death contemplation. However, it can be very powerful, very, very powerful. Therese did ask me about what happens at the point of death, and that's a whole other talk. I recommend it's a topic which I'm quite interested in. I recommend reading into near-death experiences. I think that gives you a pretty good idea of where that's going, particularly Dr. Kenneth Ring. He's got some good books. He's done research over many years. I particularly liked Lessons from the Light, which I've read two or three times. I think that's, I mean, I think perhaps one of the key things that comes out of that book is that death is a powerful teacher. And it's also not what we think it is, you know. It is just the passing of the body. And the body, it has to pass. We know that. You know, there's nobody has not died. Even the Buddha, he passed away. But the question is, what happens next? And that can vary a great deal. And of course, it depends upon our karma. But certainly, I believe people who have done a lot of good in their lives, who have just, I don't mean like, you know, like Mother Teresa and they've gone and saved people. I mean, that's obviously an amazing thing to do. But I think most people have a simple goodness to them. They care for their family, their friends, they help out their neighbours just in simple ways. I think those kinds of people, they do go to a happy place for their next lifetime. But, yeah, of course it varies because unfortunately, and this is one thing, you know, oftentimes we get very angry with people who do bad things. But if we understood the where they're headed, we actually have some sympathy for them because it's not going to be very pleasant for them. I don't know if I've answered Therese's question at all, to be quite honest. I might have to have another stab at that. Maybe Therese might come back and ask me another question because I think I haven't really dealt with her question very well at all. But I do believe, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, we are heading up to meditation time.
You are indeed most correct, Sol. I'll leave it over to you.
If anyone does want to ask a question after the meditation, or they can type one in to the chat, I'll try and get to them straight after the meditation. Okay, meditation time. First thing, and you'll see I'm going to get myself ready for meditation. Got my chair. I'm going to sit cross-legged on my chair because I like to do that. If that suits you, you can do that. If it doesn't, that's okay. The most important thing is that you find that you are comfortable for the next half hour. And I'm going to set a little alarm. So we know when the end comes. Okay. Set the body up first of all. Make sure that the body is comfortable so that you can sit steadily and calmly for 30 minutes. And then direct yourself into the present moment. How do you feel now? How does the body feel right now? How does your mind feel right now? Do you feel sleepy, restless, stressed, anxious, at ease, however it is that you feel right now. Just note that feeling without a sense of judgment. And then notice the next present moment. Having a sense of kindness and ease towards this present moment. This present moment is all we need. It's good enough just as it is. If there's any thoughts taking you off into the future or into the past, just note those thoughts and let them go. Coming back to this present moment. When the time is right for you, you can direct your attention to the sensation of breathing. Just be content and at ease with one full in-breath. Content and at ease with one full out breath. This is good enough. This is all we need. Knowing the breath coming in, going out. the mind wanders. Don't get into an argument with yourself. Just note that it has wandered to the past, to the future, to one of the five hindrances. And then let that be. Meditation is not about making the mind perfect. It's about accepting with kindness the present moment. The more acceptance we have, the more we draw our attention towards the breath. More it becomes just enough on its own. Getting closer now to the end of the meditation. Step away from focus on the breath. Notice how you feel now. What happened over the course of the past half hour? What causes led to how you feel now? Take a moment to reflect. On what has transpired in this past half hour of meditation. And gently come out of the meditation. Okay, if you want to make yourself comfortable, okay. Now, I think now is the time for questions and comments, complaints.
Yes, we do actually have something in the chat here. Very inspiring talk. I love the reflection on how useless it is to demand perfection from others if we recognize their impermanence. Thank you, Sophie.
I did want to add something
To Therese.
to Therese, yeah, and maybe she might want to come back. One of the
Therese?
ref Therese, one of the reflections that I have with regards to death and dying is to kind of, well, ask yourself, well, what if the situation was the opposite? What if we had, what if we were immortal? Well, if we were immortal, our lives would be meaningless and worthless. Might sound like it doesn't make sense, but it makes perfect sense. It's like in economics, you know, supply and demand. If there's an unlimited supply of something, it has no value. We'd be reckless and foolish, and it wouldn't make any difference. It wouldn't make any difference what we would do because we'll be immortal. So, and we'd have a limitless amount of time with people. So let's say people who are in our family or people who are friends, we would be with them forever and ever and ever and ever and ever, which might turn out to be a lot of suffering, to be honest. But if it's not, it would not be valuable. One of the things that makes our lives important and valuable, and the time we spend with the people we care about valuable, is that it is limited. It's a limited supply of time. It's the one thing that we don't have, we feel like we don't have that much of. So when you look at it that way, and then you can start to say, well, you can start to reflect upon the time that we had with people that we care about and realize how valuable it was. And I think so long as we can also get past any thoughts of wishing it was different and just appreciating everything for what it is, I think that can be a really valuable thing as well. I don't know if that, again, I still don't know if I've answered Therese's question, but I had a go at it. I'm a little bit congested tonight and I'm a little bit woolly-headed, so I apologize if I haven't really hit the mark.
No, it's been great, Saul. Thank you. I think I liked how you did interweave on the reflection on impermanence because it is about that for ourselves and for people who are within our sphere of space. But I think it's about holding the space, working with other people, holding a space for others to allow grief or the processing of grief for them. And in a way, compartmentalizing that for ourselves, but then allowing space. And that's what I loved about the beauty of kindfulness. Yeah. So there's lots of bits that I've picked up. And certainly the authors and the books that you spoke about, I think that would be really good to tap into as well.
Yeah, I think I really recommend Lessons from the Light. It's a really valuable book. I think it'll help you a great deal.
Thank you very much.
Is there any other questions?
You just have one more comment here from Jennifer. Thank you for the brilliant talk on perfectionism. Could you kindly share how you personally deal with this habitual tendency, as I'm definitely quite a perfectionist, with much gratitude.
Well, I think first of all, when we're in perfectionist mode, we are looking out often. We're often trying to impose our perfectionist ideals upon ourselves or upon the world out there. And I think the first thing we need to do is to stop and look back at that tendency and go, well, hang on, that is a tendency of perfectionism. So we've got to identify it. That's the number one thing I would say. Secondly, try to see cause and effect and to see that one of the effects of perfectionism is suffering. It's stress, it's anxiety, it can even be depression. Because if we're aware of that, and I don't mean aware of it as in, oh, you city idiot, now you're all depressed, you know. I don't mean that. What I mean is you can see that, oh, I had these impossibly high standards and now I feel anxious or now I feel stressed, and that there's a cause and effect relationship going on there. Because when we become aware of that, we naturally want to let it go. And that's a really, really, so bringing mindfulness to it is my second point about it. And I think, look, you know, the thing about the mind is it naturally wants to gravitate towards happiness. So when it perceives clearly that there's suffering in a particular tendency that one of our behaviors, we naturally kind of start to let go of it. And maybe the third thing is that rather than getting angry at this kind of deluded tendency of the mind, we start to say, well, look, this is got something valuable to teach me, and I can learn from this. And hopefully one of the things we can learn is letting go, because letting go is the opposite of what perfectionism is trying to control everything. So when we understand that, we can start to say, well, okay, well, let's try the opposite. Let's just try letting go. Let's try being, you know, I would, you know, the cure for arachnophobia is to have a spider come and walk across your hand. Maybe if you've got strong perfectionism, maybe the thing to do is to try to be imperfect. You know, wear your clothes just a bit messed up. If that's your thing, you know, you like to have your appearance perfect, make it a little bit messed up or whatever, you know. Maybe find that area of perfectionism and then kind of just go against it and then laugh at it, you know, just have fun, because that's the opposite of what perfectionism is doing. It takes everything too seriously. I don't know if that answers the question, but I'll hopefully that is a little bit useful.
I like that, Sol. Have fun with it. I think that really is the answer. A good laugh every now and again can definitely break that sense of perfectionism and also talking about our desire to be perfect. Sky has a comment here. I have heard that perfectionism can lead to alcoholism or addictions in general. Would you like to comment?
I think that's, again, I think yes, it can do, because the stress and anxiety is one of the things that can lead to addictions. And then also remember what I said at the start, something that I perceive is that this perfectionism, which is functional, where people are working very, you know, very assiduously, putting in long hours and trying to make things perfect. But then there's the opposite. There's perfectionism, which says, well, if I can't be the perfect student, I'll be the perfect class clown. I'll go to the opposite extreme. And I think that's possibly where that can come in as well, where, you know, you can just kind of like drop out. If the expectations become too much of a burden, well, I'm just going to drop out. So I think that can potentially be a way it can lead to addictions as well. Peace says, has she got a question? Thank you for the deeply nourishing talk. Okay. I'm pleased to hear that.
I think she echoes sentiments that many of us are feeling this evening, Saul. But we do have a question down here from Melanie. What do you think about giving advice to family members or close friends when you have the feelings that they're not doing the right things? Is it trying to control?
That's a really good question. It's a tricky one. First of all, I'll tell a story. I won't name who it is, but when I was at Bodhinyana Monastery as a monk, I remember there was a monk who came from Thailand. He was an American monk. He's an abbot now, but I'm not going to name him. It's quite a good story, though. A lot of us juniors, we had a lot of respect for him because he was so refined, like the way he wore his robe, the way he walked mindfully, the way he was so restrained in his speech and everything like this. And he was a very dedicated meditator. And in fact, he even sat for 24 hours at one time for it to celebrate his birthday. But he got some very good meditation. He got really good meditation on the Rains Retreat of that year. And his countenance, everything about him changed. He went from being controlled to completely like flowing and at ease. Everything changed because of that deep meditation. And I asked him, I talked to him a bit later on, and I asked him about his meditation. He said, oh, he had a mantra, and his mantra was, relax, everything is out of control. So I think perhaps the starting point is just to accept that everything is out of control. You know, your family is out of control, you know. And, you know, our job isn't to change them. It's to love them for who they are. Now, having said that, you know, if we've got a, it doesn't just mean we don't always have to accept all kinds of behavior, which might be very harmful behavior. We might be in a position, you know, especially if you're a parent, you know, you've got to give some guidance to your children, but also perhaps to other members of your family. If they are open to your advice, then, yeah, give that advice, help them, and in a supportive kind of way if you can. So it's really, it takes a bit of wisdom and a bit of judgment to be able to know the right time, the right place, and perhaps also the right method, insofar as rather than trying to preach at them, but to maybe ask them some questions that get them to reflect upon their behavior, which might not be a very skillful behavior, it might be a very harmful behavior, get them to reflect upon it and make sure that they know that there's a way that they can do things differently, which is, and that they can, that can change as well. Yeah.
Right. Thank you. Martha has a question here. Do you have an opinion on the CHIP system in AA and the key tag system in Narcotics Anonymous, both of which require perfection and cause me feelings of terror and shame for not making it?
Okay, I'm going to have to pass on the CHIP system because I'm not familiar with it. I will talk to the second part of the question.
Just 1 second. So would you like to unmute yourself and speak? You'd be most welcome to, if you would.
Yes, this is Martha. I was just wondering if you have an opinion on the CHIP system and the key tag system in AA and NA, because the hope or the ideal in those programs, Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, is that you will quit and never pick up again. So on the one hand, they say it's a 24-hour reprieve, or you know, it's just one day at a time, but there's a system in which people get rewarded with a white chip saying, I'm going to commit myself to this program. And then in 30 days without a drink or a drug, you get a chip or a key tag. And then in 2 months, you get another chip or a key tag. But what happens for those who quote unquote relapse is they have to keep coming back to get a white chip over and over and over again. And it seems to bring up that which you were talking about, you know, rebellion and shame and guilt and terror. And I'll never be good enough to do this, so why bother? It's a chip that rewards perfection in a program that is really supposed to be just one day at a time. I don't know if you have an opinion.
I think perhaps you've partly answered that question. I don't know what those programs are like, so I can't really comment in any detail. What I will say is that when I quit drinking alcohol, which for me was quite difficult because I was I drank every day, and I think it was kind of like a refuge for me or an escape. And it took me 6 months. It wasn't something that I was able to do all at once. The interesting thing was that for me, the thing that prompted me to quit drinking was meditation. And I remember very clearly, I started meditating. I used to go on the Saturday afternoons. And one afternoon, for some strange reason, I went home and I had a few drinks. And then I thought, oh, I'll just sit and meditate, you know, after I was had a few drinks. And I saw for the very first time what my mind was like when I was inebriated. And it was really unstable. And I'd never, ever considered this. I never looked at it directly. And it was a bit of an eye-opener. And then also I just kind of reflected back upon all the stupid things I'd done. I'd been drunk. I'd done some really, really bad things when I was drunk, you know. I'd done some, yeah. And I think I caused a lot of difficulty. So just reflecting upon the danger and difficulty of that habit. And, you know, I think I really wanted to be free. But I would also say one other thing, and I think this might help you as well in regards to your question. I think you need to have a positive substitute. I think it's all very well to say, okay, I'm going to quit this. And that's good. And I think it's good to reflect upon the danger of it. But I think it's also good to say, okay, I'm going to have a positive substitute. So like a little reward for yourself. And I guess for me, I at the time with alcohol, that was meditation. And it was making me feel a lot better. So that became its reward in itself. And I looked forward to having greater clarity. And of course, you know, alcohol was not doing, it was doing the opposite, wasn't it? But I always found that, you know, being practical, like say for instance, you want to develop a daily meditation habit, you know, maybe if you really like, you know, having a coffee in the morning, just okay, meditate. Then have your coffee. And then, you know what, you'll enjoy your coffee so much more at the end. So there's that positive reinforcement. So, yeah, I think that having some sort of positive reinforcement can be really, really good for you as well. Oh, and by the way, this is good for everybody, spend some time reflecting upon your goodness. If you spend one day, you know, you're having a problem with alcohol or addiction, and you spend one day without it, reflect upon what a good person you are for spending that day, for making that step. You know, reinforce the positive feelings that are associated with it.
Thank you, very helpful. Positive substitute, reflect on goodness. Thank you. And yeah. Also, start contract.
Yep.
When you're...
And it's a practice, you know. Practice means that we don't necessarily get there all at once, but we can get there in stages. It's like, you know, when you're meditating and when you spoke, you go, okay, let's watch the breath. Now, if you every time that your mind wandered off the breath, you beat yourself up and say, oh, you're an idiot, you're a fool, how come you can't watch the breath? It's so simple. Well, you're just going to develop a lot of negativity towards the breath, right? You know, been there, done that. I know all about developing negativity to the breath. Don't do it. It's the wrong way. But if you just say to yourself, okay, you know, oh, there you go. The mind's gone again. Okay, I was daydreaming. Okay, I can forgive that. I can start again. And give yourself that permission to start again. Just have that kind of patience with yourself. And you can do that if you are trying to get out of an addiction and you stuff up, just have that sense of patience and calm and forgiveness, but also that sense of, this is so worth it, I'm going to start again. And eventually it will succeed.
Beautifully said, Sol. There are so many addictions that we all face every day in our lives in so many different ways. And thank you, Martha, for raising that question. It's an excellent question. I'd like to ask you a question for the group, and how things go with the group. Sandra Henville on a recent podcast spoke on how it's not enough to join a meditation group, to drop out, to tune in. It simply doesn't work that way, she said. I'm wondering, as an online group, do you have any suggestions for how we can develop greater connections between members? Because
it's a tricky one. I'm not entirely sure, which is a strange thing for me to say, because I have been working in the online space for, 25 years. I don't know, a long time. I think if the will is there, then you can find a way. I mean, there's so many different mediums to communicate these days. I think, you know, use your imagination. Is there a way that you can surprise one another with a little gift? Or I don't know. Can you get together and celebrate something? Or I'm not really sure. I do think if there's a will, there's a way. I think probably one thing I just keep in mind is that the online group is here to support one another's practice. And I think the very fact that you come together even once a week, that in itself is supporting that goal. So, you know, don't shortchange yourself. Look at the good that's being done in and of that, just in what you're doing so far. If there is a will to do something else, explore that and use your imagination. Yeah, I'm not too sure I have anything specific, though. It's really up to the group as to what they want to do.
I think that invitation is a good one. Thank you very much, Saul. That's a very good invitation for everyone.